Well, hello there, and welcome back to another episode of the Untangling Toys podcast with me, Lego Master Model Builder, Sam Saxeri. This is a podcast about all things toys and play, where we talk about toys and how they facilitate good play, and how and why play is so important to life for kids and for adults. On today's episode, I'm going to be answering some questions we got from you guys. If you have questions or suggestions for episodes, things we should talk about on the show, you can email us at untanglingtoys@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. We are already getting some really nice comments and questions. All right, let's get into it. Our first question is from Crystal Mad 17. Do you still own your very first toy, and what was it? I don't remember what my first toy was because I was a baby at the time. Next question. No, I'm just kidding. I don't remember exactly what my very first toy was, but I have some toys I remember having my entire life. So this is a plastic Stegosaurus Play School. Oh, I guess this was made by Play School. It's quite a sturdy little guy. Fits in the palm of your hand. Yeah, really nicely detailed. The skin's very textured. The spines along the back of the Stegosaurus are pokey. The good thing about these not being too big is that they can't get bent over or broken after lots of play. There's not a lot of articulation to this toy. The tail, there's one joint where it bends right there, but that's about it. I was really into dinosaurs, as a lot of kids are, and I would use this guy to reenact scenes from The Land Before Time and also the dinosaur scene from Fantasia, which made me feel very sad when the Stegosaurus was defeated. Well-made Stegosaurus toy. Another toy I had from a very early age was this metal red tractor. My grandpa gave this to me, and he had a big red tractor similar to this. It also came with a trailer. My grandpa had a very similar tractor trailer set up like this, and he would give us rides in the trailer. Look, this wooden peg was in the back of the trailer. I've been looking for this. Remember episode 2 when I did wooden trains? I talked about how this piece was missing its pin. That's where it was. I knew I put it somewhere. Okay, so now I can glue that back in there. The good thing about having a trailer, any kind of cargo space on a toy, is that you can fill it up with other toys no matter what you're playing. So I would love putting army men or Lego pieces in here and pulling them around places. Put my toy dinosaurs in there. Pull them around Jurassic Park. Gatekeeper! Okay, and then this other one's not really a toy, but it's definitely something I played with a lot as a kid. Oh dear. What a mess. This is some kind of plastic bottle stopper. If you opened up a bottle, you could stick this in the neck of the bottle, push the plunger in, and it would keep the drink fizzy. I just liked playing with this a lot as a kid because before that rubber, now the rubber has completely disintegrated. I liked bouncing it along on this plunger here like it was a pogo stick. I don't know. There was just something about this. I always wanted to play with it. It's my version of that little metal ball that Grogu likes to play with in The Mandalorian. I would always sneak into the kitchen drawer where this thing was stored and take it out to play with it. Got it up there on my shelf with a bunch of other sentimental toys, but it's quite dissolved there. And then I still have Lego bricks, Duplo bricks, some stuffed animals. This wasn't my first stuffed animal, but it was my favorite. It is a Dimetrodon, another dinosaur. Yeah, this was great. It's like a beanbag. Just throw it around wherever. It was my pet dinosaur. Next question. You good up there? Okay. Next question comes from DonLino3246. I think I saw a video discussing the potentially inverse relationship between complexity of toys and use of imagination. Like how a stick and a clump of dirt requires a lot of imagination, but a model train doesn't. Curious what your opinions are on that. So to me, this is a question of like how, if a toy is more abstract, does it take more imagination to play with it? Talking about Lego, this would be if you built something just out of a few random blocks and said, okay, it's a bird versus getting a really detailed bird kit. Does it take more imagination? So I think it takes more imagination to play with rocks and sticks in the dirt and play trains that way than if you had a model train layout. But I don't think it's a... Going back to wooden trains that we went over in episode 2, I was a big Thomas the Tank Engine fan, but the train toys I had for my Brio tracks were these non-Thomas the Tank Engine ones. See, they don't have faces. This is a large black engine, and this is a little green engine. But I would still play with these as if they were Thomas the Tank Engine toys. I didn't get actual Thomas the Tank Engine toys like these until I had my nieces and nephews to play with. But I would pretend that this big black engine was Gordon because Gordon was the big train. And I would pretend that this little green one was Thomas because Thomas was the little one. Or else I would pretend that this little green one was Percy because Percy was green. I guess it takes more imagination to look at this and say, all right, this is Gordon the train, because I am imagining all of the details that are on Gordon here. But I also played other games and scenarios with these wooden trains than just Thomas the Tank Engine characters. I had had specifically the Thomas the Tank Engine branded ones where they look so much like Thomas, it might have been, it's hard to guess, but I might have felt like, oh, this must be Thomas because it looks like Thomas. This one could be something else. This could be a different train, or it could just not be the main character in what we're playing with here. It's taking a little more imagination to pretend that these trains are Thomas the Tank Engine trains, but then they also have the open-ended option to be other trains altogether. I think I noticed this a lot with Lego sets as they became more detailed as well. See, this is a very detailed Boba Fett Lego minifigure. There's all kinds of printing on it. There's a little cape thing. There's a helmet, and the helmet is very accurate to the movie. There's a jetpack. This is very cool. This is very detailed. I would have loved this as a kid. For me growing up, though, this was my Boba Fett. This was one of the bad guys from the Aqua Zone series. Not very screen accurate, but had a helmet, had a jetpack sort of thing. So when I played, this is what I pretended was Boba Fett. And I'd pretend pretty much anybody wearing white could be a stormtrooper. And I totally get why kids and adults go so crazy for these Star Wars minifigs, because they do look awesome. I would have loved to play with a ton of these as a kid. But that might have caused a similar issue, like with the Thomas the Tank Engine train. If it looks so much like the thing it's supposed to be, will I ever play with it in any other ways? Dissatisfaction is actually a pretty big driver of creativity. I'll take whatever I've got around me and cobble it together into the closest likeness that I can. So for a young age, that might mean taking blocks and sticks and dirt and making my train tracks. And then at an older age, that might mean taking styrofoam and model train parts and making a model train layout that's far more detailed, but I think it's got the same imaginative engine behind it. I think one of the benefits of playing with toys is that they're very versatile. So if you're playing with wooden toy trains, the good thing about that is you can build it in lots of different ways. Practice that creativity a lot. If you're building a really painstakingly detailed scale model train layout, I think you're still playing and using a lot of imagination. You're just not doing it in an open-ended way. Because, yeah, you know, the intention of that scale model isn't to take it apart and do other things with it so easily. I mean, I really like scale models. I think it's really imaginative the ways people find to recreate details, real life details, in tiny scale. That's very imaginative work. And just because you're looking at it and it looks like a one-to-one copy of the real thing. Like if you're looking at a model train track house and it's got such detailed fencing and the wood grain, you can see the wood grain in the building and all of the flocking around there. It looks so great. Yeah, you don't have to imagine it's a house because it looks so much like a house, but somebody put a lot of incredible work into recreating all those tiny details. Yeah, I would agree with you that abstract toys take more imagination, but it still has to do with the medium, because if you do get that creative urge, I really want to make an accurate representation of this thing in my head, then yeah, you know, you might start with abstract forms, but then you add on more layers of detail and more layers of detail and more layers of detail. That's how most really big creative projects start out, is, okay, here's just a sketch, a rough sketch, very abstract, and then you keep iterating on it to figure out where all the details will go. And that's how I built pretty much all of my Lego models. I couldn't find my Lego notebook, but if you could look through the pages, a lot of my drawings for complex models are just shapes and scribbles, because that's the first stage. And it takes a lot of imagination to look at those shapes and scribbles and figure out what all the details are going to be. So it's like 3 a.m., nope, 4 a.m., and I'm just editing this episode, and I realized I did not record a transition to our ad break. So we're going to take a little break right now, but stick around, because we'll be right back with more of your questions, including, how did I become a Lego Master Model Builder? See you then. Next question is from the Space Noodle 9786. Do you think Lego friend sets that are specifically for little girls are a move in the right direction, or take away from the gender neutralness of the marketing for Legos? I like the Lego friend sets for many reasons. For one thing, they've really expanded the colors that are available in the Lego palette, which is great for no matter what you want to build. It's good to have more colors available. And the other thing is that the Lego friend sets are really impressive builds. They're really playable. They're very fun builds. I mean, I don't know why I bother sitting down. So here's the friend's treehouse, and this is an incredible build. It's full of details and really creative building methods, and it's got a lot of play functions to it as well, like this windmill up here that moves an elevator on the back. There's a slide. Oh, I should talk more about these slide pieces. These slide pieces and tubes is something they came up with for friends, and it's just opened up a whole new possibility for kinetic Lego sculptures like great ball machines. It's tubes. Tubes where things can slide around on, and it's a whole modular system for that. And you can see on the backside of it, they're really detailed builds. And I don't really think Lego was being gender neutrally marketed, especially not in the 90s and 2000s. They've just always emphasized a different style of play, which is a little bit more action adventure-y, whereas the Friends line is more based on relationship, hence Friends, friendship. And I also think it's an incredible accomplishment that they made a new system of play inside the Lego system of play. So the dolls are very different than minifigs, but the bricks are still very, very interconnected. In fact, so we can take this Friends doll's hair off and put it on Johnny Thunder there. Now he's got a really cool hairdo. There are 10 new pieces they made for the Friends line that are still compatible with Lego minifigs, like forks, hair pieces, costume pieces, all sorts of stuff like that. The Friends line, I don't think that Lego isn't being gender neutral anymore, because I don't think they were ever really gender neutral, at least not with their marketing. But by creating other lines of play, the Friends line is being more gender inclusive in the same way that any kid could play with the Lego Friends line, just like any kid could play with Lego Star Wars or Lego City or Lego Ninjago. Honestly, I think the dolls are what get most people held up because they're not minifigs. If they were just making Friends sets but were including regular minifigs, I think people would just think that these were the more colorful Lego sets. They wouldn't think they were being specifically targeted towards girls. I mean, if you're going to eventually take it apart and build your own thing anyway, it doesn't really matter who it was marketed to. I think the Lego Friends, particularly the dolls, are Lego trying something new while still making it compatible with their existing Lego system, which is what they've always done. But I think kids who wanted to play more dollhouse style play can now do that with the Lego Friends sets, and they were probably doing that already in a way with normal Lego minifigs, but now you got something more custom to that. And is that really any different than when I had this guy and I would pretend he was Boba Fett versus actually having a Boba Fett minifig? Next question is from The Gaming Rooster 7 asks, what are Lego sets for playing with or displaying? Because my mom wants me to play with my sets in order to keep them, but I want to display them because I am happy about them. I worked hard on them, so I want others to see how hard I worked on them. That is a good question. I think what's arisen a lot in the recent decade is whether Lego is a building block toy or a model toy. Is the primary purpose of play to build a really cool looking Star Destroyer, or is it to free build, to build something interesting, play with it, and then make it into something new? And I would kind of say Lego has tried to have it both ways by saying it's a toy that you can create anything with while also releasing these really expensive sets that it's almost impractical to say, okay, now I'm going to take apart this expensive toy that has really specific colors and pieces to build one thing, and then I'll build lots of other things out of it. Here's an example. This is the Lego Hogwarts castle, which costs like $500 or something. And what else would you do with this except display it? This thing is a display piece. In fact, a lot of the Lego creator and ideas lines have been geared for adults to build it and then display it. And that's perfectly fine. That's a perfectly fine.
What if I dropped it?
That's a perfectly fine way of playing. But again, to compare that Hogwarts castle to this Friends treehouse, there's less specificity to this build. There's a lot of colors, and there's a lot less of the design is locked into these pieces on this build. So if this fell apart, and this kind of is falling apart, like this model is in process of the kids are playing with it, and it's occasionally losing a few pieces here and there. And eventually, yeah, this will just be something that's joined the brick bin and gets made into other things. But this was way less expensive than that Hogwarts castle. Yeah. This is the one I've been thinking about. Not buying, I've just been thinking about this. This is the Venator. Venator class, Republic Attack Cruiser, $649 American dollars, 5,374 pieces, ages 18 and up. If you built this, what else are you going to do with it other than display it? Even though Lego has been saying these are for adults, these are 18 and up builds, kids are still buying them and building them, or their parents are buying them for their kids and building them. I just think some of these sets, they're so well designed to be the thing that they are a model of, that there's There's not, at that price point, I couldn't see taking it apart for building pieces. If I have a box of mixed brick I would use for building things, I wouldn't use those. Then the other thing would be, what if you make something that's completely your own creation and it looks really good and you want to save it because you're proud of it? You made something cool. I think it takes a little bit of bravery to take apart, to destroy something you made, to make room for making the next thing. I don't think these really expensive, very purposely detailed Lego sets are are helping kids make that decision. If anything, I've come across more parents who said, my kid built this really detailed Lego model and it was expensive. How do I keep it together? How do I glue it so it doesn't fall apart? And I'm like, well, it should probably fall apart so you can build other things. But you want to save this. Okay. Practically speaking, talk with your mom about this. If you want to display it, maybe the problem is that when Lego is on display, it can get dusty. So do you have a way of keeping it clean looking? And the other is finding a place where it can be displayed, so it's not just on your floor or somewhere where it's in the way all the time. So finding a dedicated Lego shelf, something like that, and then keeping it clean could help display the ones you want to keep. And that could even be sort of your building showcase. Okay, maybe you've got three builds on there. Next time you build something and you want to display it, that means taking something out of there. And maybe that means that has to be taken apart into other things. I would ask your mom if there's a dedicated place you can display the builds that you want to build, at least for a certain amount of time, so you can celebrate the incredible work you've done. Next question is from user-XP7FO3FZ7U. I've been wondering this for a long time. Why has society deemed it so inappropriate for preteens and teens to play with Barbies, baby dolls, trucks and cars, or even just play pretend pretty much as soon as they turn double digits? I don't think these things should be looked down upon at all. Kids still have creativity as they get older, and if that is how they express it, then that is wonderful. I found it annoying and disappointing as I got older that it was no longer acceptable for me to play with these things when I still found a lot of joy in it into my late teenage years. This is one reason why I adore Legos. They are appropriate for all ages. That's a very good question. Why do we think it's inappropriate for kids to continue playing with toys as they go into their preteen and teenage years and into adulthood? As a society, probably because of the way that we value progress, and we see progress as linear. So when you're a little kid, you play with toys, and as you grow up, you need to move on to something else. Not saying that's right. I just think that's the thought process behind it. I think play isn't something you grow out of. I think it's something you grow that grows with you. Now, there are toys that are specifically age appropriate toy. The Safe Saw from Make Do from episode one. This is a toy that you could grow out of this toy once you're old enough to start using an X-Acto knife instead of this safety saw for cutting cardboard. And this shape matching ball. At some point, you won't have trouble finding the shapes and putting them inside the corresponding holes. This is an early learning toy. This is another toy from my grandparents' basement. That thing has held up well. Oh, look, it's by Tupperware. This was made by Tupperware. Good stuff. And so I think a lot of playing with toys is seen as inappropriate for older kids, not because there's something about the toys themselves. It's because we don't want older people to act childish. And I think we mix up what is childish with what is childlike. Childish is behaving like a kid even when you're too old to behave that way. If a five-year-old throws a tantrum in a store because he can't have the cereal he wants, that is a child causing a ruckus, but they're a five-year-old and they haven't matured to process disappointment and not getting what they want the way that a 12-year-old or a 15-year-old or a 30-year-old has. Should have. Childlike is the good things about being a child, having a really open mind, having a lot of creativity, having a sense of play and fun. A childlike adult would be an adult who has, you know, grown from childhood into adulthood. You've gotten more maturity and more experiences, but you haven't forgotten about or neglected that sense of play and creativity you're born with as a kid. If anything, you fostered it and it's grown even more. So you're almost more childlike as an adult than you were as a kid. But childlike gets mistaken for childish a lot. And so we're eager to move past things that are childlike for fear that they could be a sign that you're still being childish. And I think that leaves a void in the lives of teenagers and adults because they need to play. And so we just find ways of masking play as we grow up. You know, those really big, expensive Lego sets that we talked about. Lego's trying to target an older demographic that'll buy those, play with them, and then display them or collect them. And collecting
is a form of play. Sports are absolutely a form of play. There's just more prestige around sports. I think a lot of open-ended play that we do with toys might be more accepted in video games. A lot of open-ended sandbox-style video games. I think it's more acceptable for an adult to be playing video games. And for a lot of adults, play has to have this measurable, profitable outcome. Brain games, where it's like, I'm playing, but I'm helping my brain. Or, you know, I'm playing Wii tennis, but it's actually exercise. It's not like those results are not good, but you can play without an objective. An objective can often make you too nervous when you're playing to really open up and have fun. We don't have a lot of respect for amateur arts. If you want to play an instrument, if you want to be in a play, if you want to paint a painting, generally people think, oh, well, you got to be really good at it and you need to dedicate yourself to it. And we don't have a lot of appreciation for people doing things just for the fun of it, which is what amateur means, doing it for the love of it. And so when you lose that, I think a lot of that, you lose opportunities to play as an adult when there isn't, yeah, when that isn't an option. I almost want to say that there should be a bad term called adultish, which would be the other end of the spectrum from childish. So if somebody is an adult and they're acting childish, that means they're acting younger than they should. But if somebody is an adult and they're acting adultish, that means they're acting without imagination. Like they're not acting like the whole person. They've forgotten their childhood. I think one of the benefits of studying play and of practicing play is that it helps you keep all of yourself from childhood to adulthood in one person. So if you see an adult doing something that's very uninspired, you could say they're acting adultish. And you can blame an adult for acting adultish. I don't think you can really blame a kid for acting childish because they're a kid. They're a child. That's the age they're supposed to be. And that's what they're working through. But an adult has had all the experience and age to live and work through that. So don't act so adultish. All right, next question. This is from Rick Nerdvaro 44. Actually, this came in from a whole bunch of people. How did you become a Lego Master Model Builder? Ah, that is an interesting question. Ah, and it looks like we're out of time, so we'll be back next week to answer that. So first I want to define actually what a Lego Master Model Builder is, because there's all kinds of different Lego designer model builder jobs. There are the Lego designers who actually design the sets that you see in stores. That team all primarily works out of Billund, Denmark, out of the Lego headquarters. And then there's also Lego certified professionals. And these are people like Nathan Sawaya. They don't directly work... No, they don't directly work for Lego, but they are certified from Lego, hence Lego Certified Professional. So like Nathan Sawaya, his whole Art of the Brick gallery. Or a while ago, I was helping to install a museum gallery exhibit of Lego towers, and those were created by an Australian Lego Certified Professional named Ryan McNaught. And then there's also the model teams. They work in the model shop. They build those large-scale builds that take teams of people that have animatronics on the inside of them that go into the Lego theme parks around the world. And then Lego Master Model Builders work in the Legoland theme parks and discovery centers. The way I became a Lego Master Model Builder is they were opening up a new Legoland discovery center, and they have something called Brick Factor, which is a building competition. First, you apply to it, you make an application video, and then if you're selected, you go on Brick Factor. It's kind of like the TV show Lego Masters. There's different prompts, and you don't know these prompts ahead of time, but it's like, build something that expresses yourself, build something that's an undersea creature, you know, those kind of prompts. So the first round was 20 minutes, and then the second round was 20 minutes. If you were selected to move on to the finals, that was an hour-long build, and I won, which this was pretty surprising. I have an eclectic creative background, and I think a lot of people who become Lego Master Model Builders or who come to work for Lego come from very unique backgrounds. There's not really one track, which I think is great because it means there's not one type of person who can do this sort of thing. Lego is for all types of people. As a kid, I was always building things, but it's similar to that question we answered earlier about when you start to get older, it feels like, are you supposed to still be playing with toys? I sort of discovered by chance that if you're building a little city and then using it to film a movie, like a stop motion movie or a puppet movie or something like that, that's a more mature pursuit. It's okay to play pretend if you're making a movie. So that got me into making movies in high school, and then I went to film school, and it was while I was in film school that I really wanted to do theme park design. And my sister, who had gone to architecture school, her roommate had gotten a job as an Imagineer through the Imagineer College program, Imaginations. So as soon as I was old enough to do that, which is like junior year, I was doing a lot of that. And I think my goal throughout most of college was to either be a comedy writer or a theme park designer. But then shortly after graduating from college, two things happened. First of all, I realized I didn't have enough of an engineering background to do most of the jobs that Imagineering is generally hiring for. work. I tried to get a little more experience. I worked at this really cool makerspace fabrication shop, machine shop, and I got to learn a lot about engineering and machinery. But the other thing that I realized was that what I liked more than like building things was coming up with a story. Having a story to tell was really the catalyst for most of the things that I built. So I wanted to focus on writing, and specifically comedy writing, because that's fun. I had always had a lot of fun writing comedies, making people laugh. So I wanted to study that more. And that's when I started taking classes in improv and sketch writing at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, which is an improv and comedy school in Hollywood. Studying and writing comedy does not pay well. For the most part, it doesn't pay at all. But it was one of the most fun things I do. As an adult, that is my playground, is being funny. But I had to do a lot of other jobs to pay the bills. Sometimes it was video editing. Sometimes it was writing. I even taught after school Lego robotics classes. But mostly I was writing and writing things and sending them out places. And one of the scripts, an audio drama show that I wrote, won first place at the Austin Film Festival. That show I wrote allowed me to, you know, move along in my career as a writer. But the thing about show business is it's a lot of waiting around. While this show I had made was in development, I was waiting and I was waiting. You know, that's how shows are developed. All right, we're going. Oh, no, we're stopping. Oh, we're going. Oh, we're stopping. It's while all this waiting is happening that I hear about Brick Factor. I primarily think of myself as a comedy writer, but I like Lego and I like playing. So I thought, all right, I'll enter into this and we'll see what happens. From that application, I got selected for Brick Factor. And then lo and behold, I win Brick Factor, and now all of a sudden I have a job as a Lego Master Model Builder. Now, just so you know, when I became a Lego Master Model Builder, that was January of 2020. The Legoland Discovery Center Bay Area was scheduled to open April of 2020. Do you see where this might be headed? So I became a Lego Master Model Builder in January. And then in February, I had to fly to Austin to record a trailer for my show that was in production. And then in March, I go to Florida to the Lego model shop there to like train to be a Lego Master Model Builder. And then I come back and then we shut down for COVID. That was my early 2020. The whole world shut down, including the show I was working on, including Legoland. So then I think we finally opened in October of 2020. That's when I moved into my workshop, and yep, that's how I became a Lego Master Model Builder. Of course, that's just when I started the job. There was so much I still had to learn on the job. Opening up mid-pandemic in a theme park that emphasizes hands-on play with tons and tons of children. That's just how I became a Lego Master Model Builder. I think most people who work for Lego come from different backgrounds. I think my story is typical in the sense that it's unique for anybody who works with Lego for a job. I'm surprised somebody didn't write in and ask, why don't you get a haircut? It's a mess. Well, that's all for our Q&A episode. Thank you all for taking the time to send in your questions. It was a lot of fun answering your questions. At least I hope I answered them. If you have a question that I didn't answer, you can reach out to us at untanglingtoys@gmail.com. That's our email address. It's the most direct way to reach us with questions or suggestions for topics that we could do for future episodes. You can follow our show at any of our social medias. They're all at untanglingtoys. And if you're enjoying this show, one of the best ways to help us at these early stages is by liking, subscribing and rating our episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to this podcast or watching this video podcast. Join us next week when we'll be talking about another toy and diving more into the wonderful world of play. Can I say wonderful world, or is that we're going to get sued by Disney? Untangling Toys is a Clamor Audio production distributed by the Cloud 10 Network. Hosted and executive produced by me, Sam Suksiri. Executive produced by Aaron Hilliard. Clamor General Manager Rich Statter. Associate Producer Ethan Aronson. Post-production supervised by Devin Ruskin. Production Assistant Samara Mullick. And special thanks to Sim Sarna and Saiba Krieger at Cloud 10.